It's Philosophy Talk.
It's quite a lovely Jackson Pollock, isn't it?
Yes, it is.
What does it say to you?
If I could see inside your brain when you're looking at a piece of art, would I know what it was like to look at that art?
It restates the negativeness of the universe, the hideous, lonely emptiness of existence, nothingness, the predicament of man forced to live in a barren, godless cosmos.
What are you doing Saturday night?
Committing suicide.
What about Friday night?
How can neuroscience help us answer the age-old question, what is beauty?
His struggle is man's struggle.
He is a loathsome, offensive brute. Yet I can't look away.
My guest is Gabrielle Starr, author of Feeling Beauty, The Neuroscience of Aesthetic Experience.
This is your brain on art.
Coming up on Philosophy Talk. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything.
Except your intelligence. I'm John Perry.
And I'm Ken Taylor. We're here at the studios of KALW San Francisco.
We're continuing conversations that began at Philosopher's Corner at Stanford. That's where Ken teaches philosophy, and I did for 40 years.
40 memorable years, John. Now, today, we're thinking about your brain on art. It's about the subject of neuroaesthetics and what it has to teach us about the experience of art.
Neuroaesthetics, Ken? I guess that means you hook up people to, like, fMRI machines and kind of look at their brain while they look at some art?
That's exactly right, John. It's a hot new discipline that combines traditional aesthetics and philosophy, and art criticism, with the very latest in brain science. It's cool stuff.
Oh, yes. Sounds really cool. How is looking at someone's brain waves or neurons firing or whatever going to answer questions about the nature of beauty or of aesthetic taste or artistic talent?
I sense a little skepticism in your voice there, John. But look, maybe neuroaesthetics can't explain what makes a particular work of art beautiful. It might not answer questions like that, but it surely can tell us something about the human experience of art because, you know, we experience it in our brains. And maybe it can tell us why some of us are able to actually create beautiful art. What does artistic talent consist?
Well, look, kid, I've got nothing against neuroscience per se. Some of my best friends are neuroscientists. But I do get a little impatient with neuroscience's constant attempts to encroach on philosophy's turf. Neuroethics, now neural aesthetics. I suppose neurometaphysics is next.
John, I think you're feeling a little obsolete or outmoded or something, dude.
Well, I'm relevant to the topic. I've got a brain. I've got as many neurons as I've got quite a few neurons left. Let's leave it at that. But name me one concrete thing or even one abstract thing that neuroscience has given to us, has revealed to us about the nature of beauty or art or artistic talent.
Well, I'll take artistic talent. That's one that neuroscience has a lot to teach us. I mean, here's a fact that philosophers could never have anticipated from our armchairs. Did you know that brain damage and brain diseases of certain kinds can actually alter an artist's abilities? And not for the worst, as you might think, but for the better. It actually can make them better artists.
Come again?
Well, yeah. Think Willem de Kooning, that famous abstract expressionist painter. He developed Alzheimer's in the later years of his life. And during that time, because of his Alzheimer's, he produced some of his best work. There's also Franco Magnani, a painter based here in San Francisco. After he developed a seizure disorder, which made him an obsessive compulsive, he obsessively painted these incredibly detailed scenes of the Italian town he grew up in, and I could multiply the examples.
Well, those are fascinating stories. Monk was obsessive compulsive in San Francisco and a great detective. So, you know, who knows? What does that show us about aesthetics or artistic talent?
Well, the point is, John, that as scientists start to study this kind of stuff more and more systematically and dig deeper and deeper into the brain, they're going to eventually know which parts of the brain are involved in artistic creativity, how those parts of the brain contribute to artistic activity, and maybe how changes in the brain can enhance or diminish your artistic talent or appreciation. That's important stuff.
Well, yeah, but you're kind of missing the point. Of course we're going to find out more about the brain. I mean, if you study what happens in the brain when people eat corn, you'll find out what happens in the brain when people eat corn. You won't find out anything about corn. What counts as art in the first place is even worse. It's essentially subjective. It's culturally contingent. Take so-called alleged conceptual art, like Marcel Duchamp's Fountain. Fountain is basically a regular porcelain urinal set in a museum. That makes it art. That's art. People certainly call it art. They feel strongly about it. I must say, I just don't get it.
I'm not suggesting that studying people's brains going to settle that question of whether that's art or not. But you got to admit, it would be interesting to actually see what's going on inside the brain of someone who thinks Fountain is a great work of art, and then compare that to what's going on inside the brain of somebody like you who, well, is kind of nonplussed by it. I mean, that would be interesting, even if it doesn't settle the question of what is art.
Could turn out fascinating, like people that like Duchamp's art need to go to the bathroom, and people who don't need to go to the bathroom usually find it kind of boring. Maybe something even more interesting than that, I guess. Okay, you find out about the brain. Maybe we could even figure out. I mean, I don't think you're ever going to explain to me what's so great about some of this stuff, but maybe if you could just directly poke my brain, you could get me to appreciate it.
Well, I think you're getting a little ahead of yourself and a little ahead of science there, but I think it would definitely be cool to see which systems of the brain are involved in perceiving, processing, evaluating works of art. What's going on in those systems of the brain when we perceive and evaluate art? I mean, look, maybe the limbic system, which controls basic emotions, is a part of it in some interesting way. I think there's lots of possible hypotheses here to investigate.
Well, I'll probably agree with you that neuroaesthetics is really wonderful before I agree with you that Duchamp's Fountain is really wonderful.
Well, you know, I got to admit, it is hard to achieve a consensus on art, especially when you're talking about modern art.
We sent our roving philosophical reporter out to ask both adults and children alike what they think a particular painting by the artist Jackson Pollock. And she compares that with what an expert says. She files this report.
One of the most famous works by abstract painter Jackson Pollock is called Full Fathom 5. It's a drip painting made by dripping and throwing paint at a canvas. It's considered a masterpiece.
It's kind of weird. I mean, it doesn't really look like anything cool.
14-year-old Kayla is not impressed.
It just looks like a pile of dirt or like the ground.
I showed adults and kids alike this abstract painting, and they had pretty different reactions.
I think it's cool. Because it has all those like different colors and the lines, and if you look closely, you can see like different things in it.
I see a person standing profile. Of course, they have a pointy head, and it almost looks like they're drinking a water bottle.
I see like a butterfly. I see something that looks sort of like a bird.
Oh, it looks like a lot of paint thrown at the canvas.
It looks like the dump. It's like boats in a dump.
Oh, I think I see a horse, actually.
For Pollock, this work was coming out of a period of exploring imagery that was very specifically imagery related to the unconscious.
Lawrence Rinder is director of the Berkeley Art Museum and Pacific Film Archive in Berkeley, California. He says Full Fathom 5 can be interpreted as an abstract representation of the mind.
As an abstract image of the fathomless condition of the unconscious, of the mind, or as a representation of a kind of a realistic depiction of a visceral sensation of groundlessness and infinity. And one can think either of being in outer space, I mean, right now you can imagine like floating in space like an astronaut, or being underwater.
Pollock created the painting in 1947, when he was seeing a Jungian psychologist to battle alcoholism. The title of the work comes from Shakespeare's The Tempest.
It's about someone who is, you know, their body is full fathom five underwater. It's a distance under the sea. They're dead.
Today, Pollock's Full Fathom 5 is housed at the Museum of Modern Art in New York. Most people, including the folks I asked to reflect on the painting, agree it's a piece of art, if for no other reason than it's in the MoMA. But nobody quite agreed on what art exactly is.
I think art is that, like, someone painted it and that they, like, sort of put stuff in it. They put drawings. They had used at least, like, two different colors.
It's art because the person drew it or painted it and put their best into it. Doing art is like just like coloring and painting. That's just art, even if you're not drawing anything.
I mean, art is a very open definition. I think people are always trying to figure out what is or isn't art all the time.
Lawrence Rinder, the director of the Berkeley Art Museum, says what we consider art or not art is not objective. It's all socially constructed, based on what we've seen on the walls of our parents' and friends' homes.
It's all learned. It's cultural. It's just a cultural response.
Jackson Pollock saw art as paint splattered on a canvas. The highly respected folks at the New York MoMA agree. Where we lack consensus is what Pollock's Full Fathom Five actually represents. And there's even less consensus on what is or isn't art. What do you think? No, really. Tell us. We posted a photo of Pollock's famous abstract painting on our Facebook and Twitter pages, and we want to hear what you think about it and how you would define art in general. While you're finding us online, I'll sign off. For Philosophy Talk, I'm Shuka Kalantari.
Thanks, Shuka, for an interesting survey of people's opinions about Pollock's Full Fathom Five. Now, my own view is that it's obviously his attempt to tell us what it's like to read Sartre underwater with the DTs. But anyway, I'm John Perry. With me is my fellow Stanford philosopher, Ken Taylor.
Today, John, you crack me up. We're thinking about your brain on art. We're joined now by Gabrielle Starr. She's a professor of English and dean of the College of Arts and Sciences at New York University. She's author of Feeling Beauty, The Neuroscience of Aesthetic Experience. Gabby, welcome to Philosophy Talk.
Thank you very much.
Gabby, you're a humanist, a professor of English, but you're also doing studies in neuroscience. How on earth did you get from English to neuroscience?
Well, when I was about 10, my dad gave me a book on the brain, and I'm now old, so that was 1984. And in 1984, brain science didn't exist in the same way that it does now. It was just about brain structures and brain injury. But I've always loved art, and I've always cared about it. My parents surrounded us with it. I learned to play the piano when I was a really little kid. And something as complex and powerful as art, I kind of feel like we should take as many tools to the game to figure out what's going on as we can. And neuroscience, as it is now in the 21st century, has a lot of really powerful tools.
Well, okay, that's an interesting story. I can sort of see how that might happen. Now, earlier it took a little convincing from Ken for me to see how neuroscience might illuminate something as subjective as the aesthetic experience. I'm still a little skeptical. I mean, come on, Gabby, one humanist to another. Is there really anything to this? Or more formally, what can you say to convince me that looking at the brain sheds light on aesthetics?
Well, all subjective experience is embodied, right? And everything that we experience is mediated by the way that our bodies work. And that's our brains, the way that we stand in front of a picture, the way that we hold an extraordinary thing. It all comes down to the ways that our bodies function. And even if these things are culturally mediated, culture rides on top of physical human beings. So beginning with the brain is not a bad question. That's the seat of perception. It's the way we integrate the future and the past. It's how we construct our sense of selves. And understanding that embodiment, I think, is important to something that's so centrally present as aesthetic experience.
I don't disagree with you in one way. I mean, I'm a materialist. I think the mind is just the brain working. But I do wonder, I do wonder how the humanistic and the neuroscientific are supposed to come together, how they come together in your view. Some people would think of neuroscience as just replacing philosophy, all high-level stuff. I mean, that is all kind of reductive to the vocabulary of neuroscience. I assume you don't think that. So what is it? I mean, how do you want to make these two things ride together? You think neuroscience has a kind of primacy or what?
No, I think the questions come out of lived experience, right? Any of the questions that we care about, they all come from what it is that appeals to us in the world and the aesthetic universe. So all of our questions, I think, come from a human perspective. And then it's the question of who has the best purchase on which problem. So while you can take criticism and can think about the history of an artwork, you can think about the reception of the artwork, you can approach the use biography to think about who the artist was and what they were seeking to achieve, as we just heard in Shuku's roving report. But then when it comes down to what might be more universal aspects of our experience, that's when thinking as a scientist actually can be really helpful, because the point of science is not to think about individuals, but to think about populations.
You're listening to Philosophy Talk. Today, we're thinking about art and the brain.
What does neuroscience tell us about artistic appreciation? Anything? Can it explain why certain works of art are universally considered masterpieces? And what about works of art that cause a lot of disagreement?
Art, neuroscience, and aesthetic appreciation. When Philosophy Talk continues.
Tell by the way she smiles, and these visions of Johanna are now all that remain.
Bob Dylan, you might love his voice or hate it. Does that just depend on how your brain processes it? I'm John Perry. This is Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything.
Except your intelligence. I'm Ken Taylor, and we're thinking about art, the brain, and neuroaesthetics.
Our guest is Gabrielle Starr from NYU, who combines being a dean, being a humanist, and studying the brain. And she's the author of Feeling Beauty.
So Gabrielle, you wear these two hats. You love this neuroaesthetics. I think you even do some neuroaesthetic research, and you're a professor of English. I want to dig into the combination of these two things and what it really has to teach us. But I want you to start by telling me us the most surprising thing that you think this research reveals.
The coolest thing that we found was that there are at least two, and most probably three, different neural systems that are involved in aesthetic experience. The first one is, you know, when you're adjusting towards limbic systems and regions for reward, those are definitely part of the pleasures that we take in artwork, much in, as they are part of the pleasures that we take in daily life. But there's one brain system in particular, the default mode network, that only is involved in really intense aesthetic experience. And in daily pleasures, it doesn't seem to become involved at all. It's a set of brain regions that are really focused on introspection, on imagining the future and the past, imagining other people and imputing their thoughts and emotions and feelings. And the fact that that's selectively present only in intense aesthetic experience is actually pretty cool.
Well, the default network is an interesting thing. We did a show on psychedelic drugs a while back, and it turns out
we did a show about psychedelics.
We weren't on psychedelic drugs when we did the show.
That's a good clarification.
Yeah, and it turns out that LSD affects the default network, and the hypothesis there was that it disrupts one sense of self, because the default network has a lot to do with self-representation and self-cognition. So why would, I mean, if that's right, if that's the right theory about, you know, the default network underlies a lot of self-representation, why would intense aesthetic experience? That puzzles me. And you have a thought about that?
Yeah, so I think that one of the things that's happening when you see a work of art or listen to one and it's really, really compelling is that it feels like it's speaking to you in some really personal way. It's not just something that it's on the wall, but it comes inside of you. And it's like you know exactly how to look or listen to it. And it also is looking back at you. And there's something about really powerful experience that feels deeply external and internal at the same time. And I think that's what's going on with the default mode network activation.
Let me ask you about what we might call inner subjectivity or inner brain activity. So I imagine myself as a scientist in the future, when they have what Feigl called a cerebroscope. You look in someone's brain at any detail you want. You can see individual neurons. You can move it around. So suppose I've got, you know, 10 people looking at Pollock's painting or the Mona Lisa. and I'm looking at all their brains, how much would I expect in common? Would the changes be in the same location? How much variation would there be in the individual brain processing of the same work of art?
So, and the perceptual processes, as long as everyone has normal perception, as in the mm-hmm. right down the middle of the fairway, you wouldn't see much difference at all. And I think that's one of the mm-hmm. things that's really, really cool.
I see.
And you would see the sensory activations pretty much the same. You also would see that people would have a certain time course to their responses, that they would spend certain amounts of time, more time, the more they care about it, less time, the less than the less they're moved. But what you would see is everyone who found it really, really extraordinary. The naysayers, they would stop at the perceptual. They'd be off at something else. They wouldn't be focused on the painting anymore. But the people who really found that artwork compelling, you would see exactly the same profile in all of their
brains. So that's interesting. I mean, I'm going to go back to John's skepticism about whether...
Former skepticism.
Yeah, well, I think the skepticism is well-deserved. I don't think it's the final word, but it's worth taking seriously. Right? That seems like it kind of to be expected in a way. I mean, people, you could think, people who take the same work of art, and some like it and some don't, in some ways they perceive the same thing. Their basic perception, if my eyes aren't fixed, broken, and your eyes aren't broken, and we look at it, we see the same colors, we see the same shape, we process them with the same brain structure. Now, if I like it and you don't, I detest it and you love it, there's got to be some other difference, not in the bare perception. I mean, so you might expect, given the essential subjectivity of art, that there's got to be some difference in the brain of people who react differently, but it can't just be at the bare perceptual level, right? I mean,
I think that's not surprising, right? It's not surprising, but what is surprising is exactly what structures are involved for the people who really, really care about the artwork. I don't think you would necessarily have predicted that the same brain structures that we use around mind wandering or self-construction mm-hmm. are involved in intense aesthetic response.
So,
there's a difference between mere liking and really powerful response.
Now, I don't know if you've done work on this. If not, I'm asking for speculations. But take the experience of reading a really good novel or short story or poem. Do you think what similarities would you see expect to find between the there you wouldn't have perceptual difference between somebody looking at a piece of art, visual art, and a person reading a good poem, but would you expect other similarities in the brain connected with the aesthetic experience?
It's really interesting to think about work with poetry and novels and short stories, and we're just starting to do some work on that in our lab. One of the things that I think you would definitely see is difference not just in not primarily in perception, but in imagined perception. Mm-hmm. How strongly people can take what's on the page, whether it's the imagined sound of a poem and the beat that you follow, how well you can follow that and how much that can influence your own responses. And people imagine so incredibly differently that if we can begin to disentangle that and understand it, we can learn a lot more about how art works and what people want from the art that they read and enjoy.
Okay, so I want to ask you a question more at that level of we just were what people want, how art works. I know, so there's a neural narrative to tell. You know, the default mode network gets involved, right? There's a neural narrative to tell about artistic, let's call it artistic cognition, artistic perception or appreciation, right? But now there's also the questions that we humanists ask. What makes art beautiful? How is art, how does the perception of art vary with culture and background, this or that? I mean, so do you think, I'm not quite sure if you believe or not, I can't deduce from anything you've said so far, whether this neural narrative is going to somehow impact or condition or change or alter the kind of narratives that we humanists like to offer about these things.
I think in some cases it can. I mean, one of the things that's been really the story of a lot of humanist inquiries, especially around literature and music and the arts, is that the work of culture is the biggest mover in all of our desires and in all of our life. But I think that we're now at a moment where we need to be reminded that the work of culture is the work of bodies, and that that can help us to move away from the idea that everything is purely socially constructed. As I had an old teacher used to say, pasta is socially constructed, but you can still eat it.
Well, that's a good point. So let me follow up on this idea a little bit. Suppose we did an examination of all the, you know, what everybody agrees are the 15 greatest landscape paintings. And we found that there's a certain property they all share. Could be a complex property, maybe a couple of different factors that are weighted differently. But all great landscape paintings share that. Call it landscape painting beauty. Now, clearly, if the brain had evolved differently, I mean, I shouldn't say clearly because nothing's all that clear to me, but if the brain had evolved differently, if culture had evolved differently, that property that we call landscape beauty might be of no interest to us at all, or it might be the one that people who look at landscapes react very negatively to. So is that an objective property if everyone were deaf, there would still be sounds, and some of them would be loud and some of them would be soft. If our brains hadn't evolved as they were, would this properties of landscape painting beauty still exist, or is it just a subjective reflection of how our brains react?
It's a complicated question because, and I know I'm not supposed to say these things, it's a complicated question.
Yes, you are.
No, that's okay.
That's a fact.
Only when they're complicated, though.
I think the short version
is... It's much better than say, that's a stupid question. So go ahead.
I'll save that one for later.
Okay.
I think that anything that you could come down to that might be that essential property in an artwork, my guess is that it's so trivial in terms of the overall liking that you have. The water is blue and it's the right blue. The trees are the right green. Mm-hmm. The world curves in the right way. None of those, I think, would actually be a convincing or compelling reason that anyone would feel or add when you ask them why they really like a work of art. I think that what neuroscience is showing us is that those properties in some ways don't really get at what art is about at all. Because if they did, there'd be much less disagreement in what people find beautiful than you can demonstrate there really is.
Yeah. You're listening to Philosophy Talk. We're talking about your brain on art. We'd love to have you join this conversation. We got a call from David in Napa, who actually didn't want to speak on the air, but he told us what his question was, Gabby, so I'll read it out. He says something, let's see. He said, art exists in context. Clowning around in modern art, Ray Pollock misses the point of modern art into postmodernism art. I'm not quite sure what he's getting at, but art exists in context, and that's important. He talked about Hegelian thesis, antithesis, and synthesis to describe the process of art movements responding to each other. I think he thinks that the neuroscience misses all that or something like that.
You want my opinion on whether Hegel or neuroscience is going to tell us?
Gabby, what do you think?
I think that Hegel is really tiresome.
You would think that.
So I think that neuroscience does miss a huge amount of the context. And again, that's about what tool you want to take when you're trying to figure out what component of art you care about. So there's absolutely no way that someone is going to walk off the street and suddenly find that urinal, the fountain, the upside down fountain, extraordinary without a huge amount of education, without a lot of training and context. So neuroscience can't provide that context, but what it can do is it can see what's happening once you have it.
Right. I mean, I think that's well put. I mean, you shouldn't. John in the opening said he resented, and he was speaking for a fair number of philosophers, and I imagine some of your English colleagues, the encroachment of neuroscience on the turf of the humanities. I don't think the resentment is well placed if neuroscience contributes what it can contribute and doesn't pretend to contribute what it can't contribute. And there are things that it contribute and things that it can't contribute. I mean, would you agree with that?
Absolutely. Well, it's funny because... No, go ahead, John.
Well, as I say, the encroachment has a very positive aspect. You get to know neuroscientists, and philosophers can sneak in on the around the edges of fundable grants. But go ahead.
Did you want to say something? I have a caller. I'm going to give you a choice. Either you can
this
say something
caller,
or take
it. Yeah.
So we've got Michael from Petaluma. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, Michael.
Hi. This is something you've kind of touched on slightly, but I was wondering if you could talk about the difference, in, even if we assume everything socially constructed, between liking and appreciation. Because, for example, I can appreciate Jackson Pollock or the statue of the urinal in the museum, but neither of them suit my tastes. I mean, as I appreciated Pollock painting, I'm in a sense willing myself to find it fascinating because I'm taking the art world's word for it, that there's substance here. It's not what I would choose to look at to give myself pleasure. I mean, to go to music, for example, I might like punk rock, and I might not get a lot of appreciation from listening to opera, but I can look at the two of them. I can see the not just the kind of cultural importance of opera and the history to it, but the complexity and how, in some ways, I might view that as being of more substance than someone screaming over loud guitars, even though I might prefer to play the latter for myself for pleasure.
Yeah, thanks, Mike. Thanks for the call, Mike. What do you think, Gabby? You did touch on this, but elaborate.
So I think that I haven't actually done any studies to isolate something like appreciation, but it's an absolute great point that you can believe something to be fine art or important without having any emotional or pleasure getting that from it at all. And one of the things that we've done in our experiments is really to try and get at people's personal responses and not that more cerebral or intellectual response.
Right, but you did refer to the fact that the default mode network only fires when the art is gripping, I mean amazingly gripping, not when you just like it. I thought, right, so there is some difference. There is some special thing that's being deeply
gripped.
There's
an absolute categorical difference between what we find deeply moving. And I think that's pretty amazing because if you just look at the statistics, people agree about beautiful faces 80 to 90% of the time. Across cultures, at any one point in time, any of us can look at a face and say, yes, that's gorgeous. Landscapes, we agree at more like 60% agreement on what a beautiful landscape is. But when it comes to a beautiful haiku, you've got like 13% of agreement. Mm-hmm. People disagree so radically. So on top of that radical disagreement, there's this really powerful personal engagement. And I think that's a great story about how art matters in our lives.
You're listening to Philosophy Talk. We're thinking about art and the brain with Gabrielle Starr from NYU.
How is neuroaesthetics going to change the future of art? Will it alter the way art is made? Will robots soon be able to make art that moves humans?
Neuroaesthetics and the future of art, when Philosophy Talk continues.
Are you someone who enjoys art for its own sake? Or do you expect art to move you in more profound ways? I'm John Perry, and this is Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything.
Except your intelligence. I'm Ken Taylor. Our guest is Gabrielle Starr from NYU, and we're thinking about art and the brain.
So, Gabby, the general question we want to discuss for this segment is how the field of neuroaesthetics might change the way we interact with art in the future. But I want to first ask a kind of specific version of that. When it comes to enjoying novels, we don't set up museums where people can go look at the original novel. We're happy just reading copies of it. But with visual art, we think it's important to have these things available in museums that are very costly. Does your work in neuroaesthetics suggest that the experience one has when one looks at, say, a two-minute movie of the urinal is different than when one goes and sees it on the museum floor, or you know, when one goes to the Louvre to see Mona Lisa? Is it really that much different than looking at a really good multi-pixel thing on the internet? Can we get rid of museums in the future, save a lot of money, put it into philosophy?
No. Fortunately for museum goers everywhere, I think that you can totally have a legitimate powerful experience of an artwork just on a screen. And I've had that when I look at photographs that I've taken, beautiful or landscape images that I've seen. But there's something about the museum that actually you can begin to quantify. And we've done some preliminary work in our lab where we had mobile EEG. And the Met Museum in New York let us go in before the general public could go in. And we had people wandering around three rooms, taking as long as they'd like to look at a set of pictures on the wall. And then we had different people look at the same images in the same order in the lab. And you really can see a difference. People agree a lot more about their emotional and aesthetic responses in the museum setting than they do in the lab setting. And just think about the kinds of details that you can't get with the technology that we have. You can't get the feeling of texture, the height and thickness of the paint spread across the canvas, the size and the differences and the depth of the color. So I really think we're still going to be going to museums in 20, 50, 100 years.
I want to ask you another question along this slightly different line, but related to the future and neural aesthetics, but it's a little indirect. I mean, you know, in schools we think reading, writing, and arithmetic. And we think that those are important because they kind of give you your brain. They organize your brain in what I'm going to call transportable ways. You learn to write an essay, then you can apply it to anything. It's a generalized skill. You learn to do mathematics, now you can do science, you can do physics, you can do biology, you know, because it's a generalizable skill. Does the consumption or even production of art do things to your brain that are transportable in that way, that will enable you to be a better thinker, whatever, perceiver? I mean, does the neural aesthetic show us anything about the transportability of?
Absolutely. There's evidence that experiences of beauty can induce states of creativity. So that learning to see beauty can make you more able to create it. And this is something that we know from those folks who go to art school, but we can see it in a different way. And I think one of the really important contributions that neuroaesthetics can make is to think about what the importance of public investment in the arts, of bringing arts back into schools where they've been taken away, of making sure that children have the opportunity to spend time learning what music really is like.
Okay, so I'm a school board member. I'm a school board member. I'm going to give you 30 seconds to a minute to convince me not to cut arts funding on the basis of your discoveries in neuroaesthetics.
So that's a really hard question in 30 seconds. Thanks a lot for that, Ken.
Yeah. Take a minute.
Okay. So here I'll switch gears. I have a colleague, Ed Vessel, who did a study for NASA about long-term space travel. Because the question is, what if you live in a world in which you're surrounded by blackness, in which you're deprived of the experience of the beautiful? What impact will that have on your psychological state? And the answer is that it would be a really bad one. And you think about what happens when you put people in really in places that there are no beauty. You live a lot less well. You're a lot less creative. You're a lot less able to apply yourself to everything else that you want to do. So art actually enhances our abilities to work with math, to read better, to think more strongly and creatively. And we can know that by seeing how much brain resources are actually devoted to intense aesthetic experiences.
Okay, but I'm an easy mark. But we've got a caller, Ganesh, driving in Mountain View. I'm all talking on a hands-free device, who has a question. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, Ganesh.
Hey, thank you, and big ups to NYU. I'm an alum myself. My comment here is more about this book called The Art and Zen of Motorcycle Maintenance. I'm sure your speakers are aware of the book, and it really digs deep into this exact topic, and I'd love to hear the perspectives. Just my two thoughts. The central thesis there is really about art, thinking about it in two ways. First, the scientific mind likes to break it down, and art equals the sum of the parts, and knowing the brushstrokes, knowing the colors, and knowing the theory behind it really adds to the value of the entire piece. The second way is the mind of the aesthetic, and that's where you can't break it down. Art only exists with the context that the prior caller talked about, and it has to be only appreciated as the entire whole. The more I've thought about that, the more I've opened up my eyes to alternate ways of understanding art. From the perspective of neuroscience, I was really curious to hear how, when you blend the science of neuroscience into thinking about art, if that really lends itself to one way or the other, or if it's maybe enhances the way of thinking about the aesthetic. I'll take my answer off the call.
Thanks for the question, Ganesh. An excellent question. What do you think, Cappy?
So one of the things that's really amazing is how much we actually don't attend to the world that is around us. We surround ourselves, many of us, with beautiful objects in our homes or in our offices, but they don't always call on our attention in that particularly intensive way, even if we've selected them lovingly and carefully because they say something really important to us. And so I think that there's something about the science of perception and the way that perception is integrated into our daily lives that can help us think about what it is that art does for us. And one important thing I think art might do for us is enable us to free our attention through having had pleasure for those other things that really matter to us.
Yeah, you know, those things that we surround ourselves with, though, try taking them away from somebody. Try, you know, because they habituate to their presence, but take them away and then suddenly, you know, the importance of that thing, don't you think, becomes...
Absolutely.
Well, I want to ask you another question. This is kind of a personal question, in a way. And you don't have to answer it if you don't want. But, you know, I think of you as an unusual humanist. Not in my side. And there are lots of people in philosophy who think philosophy and neuroscience should be smoothly merged. But I think of yours on your side of a campus, there's lots of resistance to this kind of thing. So how do your colleagues in the English department regard the kind of stuff that you do? Are they open to it? Are they resistant to it? I mean, how's that work?
I think it depends on the person. I mean, there's a history in literary study that really closely ties the psychology of reading and the psychology of imagination to what it is that literary scholars care about. And those of us who really are interested in that psychology, I've had really great responses from my colleagues. But some of my colleagues who are more historicists and who really want to believe that everything about human life comes down to local consequences, local conditions, they're pretty skeptical.
Yeah, I know. So what do you think about that debate? Do you think that debate among humanists about how to relate to things like neuroscience, is that a debate that can be fruitfully engaged? Or is it just, you know, these people are over there, their people are over there, there's never going to be any convincing?
No, I'm a little more optimistic than that. And part of it is because graduate students move things forward. As long as you can have conversations, intelligent conversations, it's really good for the academy. It's good for the humanities to make our claims for what we think matters.
So, okay, another question. You're a dean, right? One of the things some humanists feel, an approach like yours can make some humanists feel a threat of some kind of obsolescence. John and I were kind of playing with that people think that neuroscience and that can replace these humanistic inquiry. I don't think you believe that, but how would you, I mean, tell me about the ultimate relationship between the humanities and things like neuroscience as you see it. When it's all said and done, how are we going to coexist and work together in the university?
Well, I think this is what it comes down to. If I could replace a beautiful work of literature with a scan of my brain while I was reading it, and everyone got the exact same pleasure out of looking at my brain scan as they did out of reading Tolstoy, it'd all be done. But since that is not going to happen, I think the humanities have a lot of legs left.
I just want to say, as I'm sure you know, but since you're dean back there, you have one of the really great philosophy departments in the world, maybe the greatest. So I hope you're properly appreciative of all my brilliant colleagues back there at NYU.
They are the best.
And in a way, every philosophy talk episode in that way supports NYU. So you might want to think of becoming a partner in it.
Absolutely.
Gabby, on that
absolutely. Send her a bill.
Yeah. Gabby.
Not too big a bill.
Yeah, Gabby, on that note, I'm going to thank you for joining us. This has been a really stimulating conversation. I really appreciate your joining us.
It's been a lot of fun. Thanks for having me.
Okay. Our guest has been Gabrielle Starr. She's a professor of English, dean of the College of Arts and Sciences at NYU, and also a neuroscience researcher. She's author of Feeling Beauty, The Neuroscience of Aesthetic Experience. So, John, you have any neuroscientific, philosophical, aesthetical, Englishal thoughts?
Yeah. All my thoughts have to do with neurons, I think. Just art and art. whatever it was, and the Art of Motorcycle Maintenance.
Zen and the Art of
Motorcycle. Yeah, Zen and the Art of, you know, I spent a lot of time on that book. And so he brought it up, or a caller brought it up, and I was trying to remember it. I think I mainly remember it as an offbeat approach to child care, but maybe I'll reread it.
Yeah, maybe you ought to reread it. I'm not quite sure that's how I remember it. But anyway, this has been a fascinating topic. I think there's a goldmine of things here, and our conversation about them continues. It's already begun, but it continues at Philosopher's Corner at our online community of thinkers, where our motto is cogito ergo blogo. I think, therefore I blog. And you, too, can become a partner in that community just by visiting our website, philosophytalk.org.
And you can also follow us on Twitter, if you know what that is and can choose to do so. We're at Phil Talk Radio. Now, this is your brain on an art rant. It's Ian Scholes, the 60-second philosopher.
Ian Scholes, there may be a universality to art, but there's definitely a history, at least with the tools of its creation, and there was a history in its topics. Art began with emperors and gods and heroes, then moved on to episodes and characters from the Bible. It had a higher function than mere aesthetics. It was worship. It was commemoration. It was instruction. It was decoration. Art often went underground as church leaders realized that art was its own thing and did not necessarily glorify the Lord. The Enlightenment unfolded, and secular princes began to pay for the art they wanted. It became portraiture, still lifes, displays of technique. Dukes and wealthy merchants commissioned portraits of themselves, their wives, their families. The French created the Academy, which told the world what art was. Which was what the Academy said it was. Classicism, formerly used to show Socrates and Zeus in action, now showed Napoleon and the heroes of the Revolution. From gods to generals, from worship to mere adulation, art soldiered on. And then came World War I. In its aftermath, art seemed kind of silly. And thus was born Dada, a cosmic joke. Art was a urinal. Art was art written on a piece of paper. And then came André Breton, who took Dada to the Academy and turned it into surrealism. The real world began increasingly not to care. Norman Rockwell suited us just fine. Does the art match the sectional? Does it look good in the office? Is it collectible? In the 50s, the big joke was the poser asking the woman up to his apartment to see his etchings and listen to jazz and the hi-fi. Art led to smart people having sex. Art itself was just something people were driven to do. How un-American. The profit motive is the only drive that matters around here, pal. But art could make money for more people now, even the people who made it. Reproduction made art accessible to everybody in coffee table books and posters and replicas. So then, what does original even mean? What is authenticity? Questions that plague the sort of people who worry about these sorts of questions. Today, of course, we are nothing if not postmodern. Irony and sentiment collide. All of history, all of art is fair game for subject matter, for style, for everything. Which may be why outsider art suddenly has found appeal. Art by the mentally disturbed or the naive. There is Achilles Rizzoli, who would draw architectural drawings of his mother, depicted as a Baroque building. And some outsider artists bring us full circle back to worship and awe. James Hampton was a janitor in D.C. When he died in 1964, they found in his rented garage a meeting place for the Second Coming, with thrones that he had made out of office furniture and aluminum foil. I saw this in a museum in 1974, and it was amazing. Until I got up close and could see it was just glue, folding chairs, and foil. But even then, I was amazed at the DIY of the thing. You work with what you have, not marble, not oil, just stuff you find in the dumpster or at the drugstore. The difference now is how we look at art. We no longer swoon in the face of the divine, I don't think. We no longer feel aesthetic bliss, if we ever did. If we did, we'd stop making new art, wouldn't we, and just swoon at what we already had. So let us now be dazzled and bemused and be happy. Art today is simple. Find a picture of this throne room online, download it, print it, take a picture of that with your antique Polaroid, then Instagram that, put a frame around it, post it on Facebook. Voila, art. Oh yeah? Prove it's not. I gotta go.
Philosophy Talk is a presentation of Ben Manila Productions and the trustees of Leland Stanford Junior University. Copyright 2016.
Our executive producer is David Demarest.
The program is produced by Devin Strolovich. Laura McGuire is our director of research. Dave McAllister is our director of marketing.
Thanks also to Colin Peden, Merle Kessler, Erica Topete, and Mark Stone.
Support for Philosophy Talk comes from various groups at Stanford, the Friends of Philosophy Talk, and the partners at our online community of thinkers.
And from the members of KALW San Francisco, where our program originates.
The views expressed or misexpressed on this program do not necessarily represent the opinions of Stanford University or of our other funders.
Not even when they're true and reasonable. The conversation continues on our website, philosophytalk.org, where you too can become a partner in our community of thinkers.
I'm John Perry.
And I'm Ken Taylor. Thank you for listening.
And thank you for thinking.
What's going on? on here? You weirdos love this stuff.
Homer, I'm afraid they only love what's new and shocking.
You've gone from hip to boring. Why don't you call us when you get to kitsch?